Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
First and foremost, thank you for having me. It's good to catch up, and as you suggested, I'm going to try to keep this relatively casual, if you don't mind. Thank you for clarifying your main audience, and yeah, for me too. When you know whatever context we're meeting in, the fact when it was mentioned that you and I come from the same small city, it was also a coincidence, but also. I agree that a lot of hustlers come out from that city. Like you, I was born in that city. The city that is now called Taraz, back in the day was called Jambul, during the collapse of the Soviet Union and shortly thereafter. It used to be a strong industrial town, right? Taraz, as you and I know, Jambul. First of all, it used to be an ancient trade city on the Silk Road. Used to be one of the main outposts along the Silk Road. And therefore, there is a flourishing city or remnants of the city underneath Taraz that are being discovered right now. It's the city's 1,000 years old or over 1,000 years old, has tremendous history. But, you know, when the country collapsed, Taraz turned into, a terrible town. Therefore, it produced a lot of resilient people. And I believe that's what you're referring to, and I was referring to. It's a joke, but it's kind of sad when I meet other Kazakhstanis from outside of, you know, in Singapore or other developed countries. They look at me and say, are you sure you're from Taraz? And why? You're incredibly sane. I say, yeah, I am. I'm a sane person. Thank you. But are you sure you're... So it's a great pleasure to meet you. I grew up in that city. I come from a humble family, unfortunately, I faced a family loss early on. So with career paths of family evolving, moved to Almaty, which was a large city back then. I was academically inclined, so I migrated from one school to the other, improving grades, participating in various challenges, up until, you know, I won a scholarship to study in the United Kingdom. I went to do my university, my undergrad in London. But look, no regrets. I love my time in Kazakhstan and what Taraz, what the city taught me. And I'm very happy that today, you know, despite the industry still not coming back to that city, this city has improved a lot. It's beautiful. It's clean. People are nice. People were always nice in Taraz. And finally, that history the city has is being recognized. There is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And, you know, it's being publicized. And, you know, the beautiful nature is still there. So if you don't mind a side story, when I took my wife to Taraz for the first time and my kid, actually, I was a father at that point. Regina was there.
Where's your wife from originally?
She's from Shymkent.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's a neighboring city, but we met in Singapore. Like we met thousands of kilometers away from Kazakhstan, but we're from neighboring cities. So when Regina was there a couple of times before, but when I took her to the village where my dad is from, and I took Aydar, my son, who was very young at that point, still is, but there was, you know, the Taraz summer. I'm not sure if you remember it, but it's incredibly beautiful. It's green. These mountains are all covered in greenery and trees. And she looked at it and went, wow, you come from a truly beautiful place. I said, yeah, I do. Thank you. We must build a house there. We must come live here. I said, no, no, we're not coming to live here. With all due respect, I love this place, but so in hindsight, that's my take on Taraz. But I'm really excited that you're going to go there. If you don't mind my finishing my backstory, so as I said, through various academic achievements, I ended up studying in the United Kingdom in London. Specifically, graduated from a very good university there. But more importantly, build a network. My first ever network. I was pretty active as a student. And instead of doing a diploma when I was in my final year, I did a project for a company. Then I moved back to Kazakhstan, worked there on the sales side. I studied management and finance. So finance is where I've been all along. All of my life. So I started on the sell side, brokerage, insurance, then moved to buy side, fund management. Through the network I've built during uni years, I got an invite to work in this part of the world, in Singapore. So it was an asset management company based in Singapore and Hong Kong. I knew nothing about, although Kazakhstan is partially Asia, but I think you would agree it's different from Asia that is on the east side of Kazakhstan.
Sure.
So it was technically my first time working in Asia, that deep in Asia. So I knew nothing about Singapore specifically as a country. It was my first visit to Hong Kong. So I came to this part of the world, discovered it, fell in love, stayed to work, have been there ever since. In 2017, started my own business, which was on the a boutique fund management company called Paladin Capital, acquired my license. And in 2022, it evolved into a digital private bank. We're calling it Invest Bank today. So that's the short version of my journey.
Wow. Well, you're definitely understating a lot of facts there, more specifically around Paladin Capital, which I want to spend a few minutes talking about this, because it's not a small brokerage by no means. It's definitely a very successful brokerage, very successful fund. Even before having met you personally, I've heard about Paladin Capital. It's been in conversation. So let's put it that way. So that already speaks volume. That already speaks to the track record, especially in your part of the world. In Southeast Asia, is definitely a recognized brand, because even through my HBS network, there's quite a few investment bankers, VCs, and other financial professionals in Singapore and Southeast Asia. And definitely that's something that, after you and I have met, we've had conversations about the state of the market in that space, and Paladin Capital did come up. So that was, proud moment for me, because, it has been founded, it has been started by fellow countrymen, especially from Taraz. So that was, I was very, very pleasantly to hear these conversations. But tell us a little bit more about Paladin Capital, about its early stages, because, starting a fund, starting a brokerage is, nothing short of monumental task. You've mentioned the importance of network. You've mentioned the importance of relationships. So I would imagine the story goes there, because you had been very successful in building that type of network around you, with the people that trust you, with the people that believe in you. So maybe tell us a little bit more of a story. How did you get that started? How did you build that? And then we'll kind of progress into what the kind of transformation to Invest Bank is.
Absolutely. And appreciate the sentiment, John. Thank you very much. And for me too, it was an absolute pleasure to get to know actually what you did and what you're doing. So as I mentioned, I started off in an established fund management company that had presence both in Singapore and Hong Kong, with clients were mostly from mainland China. Then, of course, subsequently, when I became part of the company and grew inside the enterprise, I was for a time head of Europe and CIS desk, because basically I was given all other clients, right? Because of my diverse background, that was, so how I grew in that institution is because I believe of how I managed assets, how I built networks, participated in client conversations, in my ability to work in multinational setups and multinational teams, and work and find common ground with people from different jurisdictions. Eventually ended up becoming the CIO of the company and got some options. And there was at a certain point in time, there was a huge wave of M&A activity. Mainland China based large financial groups were you know, buying up financial institutions in Hong Kong for various reasons, you know, either expanding international presence, managing, you know, diversifying asset base, various reasons. So for that purpose, that company was acquired too, and I cashed out my options, employee stock options, and, you know, got my first sizable capital that way. And I found myself at a precipice. I always wanted, so I saw myself doing investments. I like doing that. I saw myself doing that in the long term, one way or the other. Right. And a few years earlier in 2015, I started my career as a venture investor, as an early stage investor. I can talk about that separately. But so I already was in the mindset that I wanted to be in the investment world. So, you know, I weighed my options, thought different thoughts, and decided, hey, why don't I acquire my own license? So that was a big risk for me back then. Went ahead and acquired, got a license in Singapore. Took me about 6 months, a fund management license or from a fund management regulatory status from the MAS. I was told it's really good. Normally it may take way longer, but that, and that's how Paladin Capital was born. You know, one man show with a license. What happened afterwards is when the company I was previously in was acquired, there was a small base of clients from Kazakhstan, you know, from various jurisdictions, including Kazakhstan, that the new owners didn't know what to do about. Like, so who are these people? We don't really know. So I thought, hey, if you are okay with it, why don't I take them with me under my new license? And sure, go ahead.
So there was no non-compete on none of these clauses from the previous engagement?
No. They're absolutely, absolutely friendly conversation. I had a good relationship. I think a big part of my success is building good relationship with people and, you know, acting with integrity. So they're okay with it. I got my first client base that way and grew from there. So that's how Paladin Capital started. It started off with a small client base, and we started, I started building my team, building my presence, the brand, various asset management products. And the company grew up until the point where in 2022, we had an established team, sizable AUM, and somewhat recognizable brand name. Then we saw...
Can you share some of those names?
Excuse me?
Can you share some of the insights?
You mean the client names or the...
Not the client names, but as far as...
numbers.
Some of the numbers and maybe at the higher level, what's at the core of the investment thesis for Paladin?
Yes, of course. So the first version of Paladin, because right now we have the second version called right. Investment, but the initial version of Paladin and the mission of Paladin 1.0 was to give high net worth entrepreneurs control of their financial lives. And that was our main client base, family office, high net worth entrepreneurs who have little time or maybe sometimes no time, but they have large asset bases that needed to be structured, taken care of. And I myself being an entrepreneur, I understood them very well. So we answered all the questions. You come in to us and we say, look, first of all, this is considering where we are, Southeast Asia. This is how you should hold your capital, you know, trusts, you know, sub fund structures, holding companies. Second question, what, right? We built our own investment team. I'm experienced investment manager myself. We would build a strategy, tailor strategy around your risk profile, your capital, your return requirements, and then reporting. There was a huge problem that there weren't any platforms that would satisfy immediately all of entrepreneurs' needs. And then that was true for everyone, and it's still true to this day. And because of that, we had to source, we use different platforms for different needs, mm-hmm. and then manually aggregate those. And the clients were very happy about it, because all they wanted at the end of the day, apart from good service, they wanted a single freaking statement to tell them that's how much they have in stocks, bonds, venture, and that's what's happening with it. So that, you know, they can go about their lives, and if they see any causes of concern, only then they spend time talking to and giving us a call, right? Mm-hmm. So that was we built we became boutique size from 2017 to 2022 from almost no assets. We were 100 million under assets under management, even more at one stage. But then, you know, obviously there were liquidity requirements clients had because of the war in Ukraine. I think we have a pretty resilient client base in that sense. So we started with offering individualized discretionary mandates. Then we started finding similarities in investment styles and needs of high net worth entrepreneurs. Then we started packaging some of them in funds. Now we have three in-house fund strategies. That's Paladin Atlas, which is an income fund. We have Paladin Crisis Alpha, Paladin Quantum Rock Crisis Alpha. That's a volatility hedging strategy. It makes you money when markets fall. So you have an income strategy. Great, you're generating income. But most entrepreneurs don't want to dwaddle with long short strategies. It's just not their forte. Right. How about volatility protection? You add that in your portfolio, suddenly your Sharpe jumps 20-30%. Beautiful, right? So we produce that. I can tell you more about each one of them, but only if it's relevant to this conversation. And third, apart from tailored mandates, is a venture secondary strategy called Paladin Ventures. So that's the three fund strategies that we had. That's in the first version. Mm-hmm. Shall I tell you what happened afterwards? Or?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then over the 5 years from 2017 to 2022, we were doing that, and we were, let's call it manual version. We're doing a lot of it or all of it manually. We automated some front end here and there, but it was just attempts. And we realized that we're so frustrated with the way private banking, which is a subset of investment banking, basically investment banking for affluent entrepreneurs, individuals, family offices, was set up. You know, it turned out around the world, not in just Southeast Asia. It's systems are terrible, fees are huge, minimums are huge. So, and then on top of paying all of that, we still had to manually do half of the things. We had to recheck commissions because they were often wrong, because apparently IT systems were built in the 80s and banks were unwilling to invest in upgrading them. And then we understood why they were unwilling to, but at that time, they were unwilling to do that. And then we realized we weren't the only ones, because UBS, Credit Suisse got certain constantly fined for, you know, accepting the clients they shouldn't be accepting, for selling products they shouldn't be selling, right? And then for mishandling client fees, actually UBS got fined, I think, $400 million for overcharging fees at a certain scandal. So we thought, hey, this is a huge industry problem we're dealing. We're not alone in this. So and we would start to say, hey, what if we did this? What if we built this financial supermarket where you would find all of these services that Private Bank has, but it was all digital, like Amazon, and And, you know, it had all of that capability. And on top of that, we'll put our funds inside of that platform and all of our other funds, you know, other producers have competitors' funds. And we will sell our know-how in investment management through that platform as well. And that concept started forming in our brain. Come 2022, we realize there is a whole industry that is being born at that stage. It's called digital private banking. And there were exactly about three players in the world, one in the US called Altruist, mostly B2B, two in Switzerland, one called Swissquote, one called Alpian. And pretty much, again, no one in our part of the world. We thought, I think that's it. They even have a name for it now. So we got our first round of venture funding in 2022. And we're actually in the process of rebranding ourselves into Invest Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So we're evolving into Invest Bank with a mission to empower the empower affluent millennials to take ownership of their financial lives in accordance with their worldviews. That's our mission, and the vision to become the leading digital investment platform in this part of the world in the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very exciting, and I definitely there's a lot to unpack here. But more importantly, I'm curious, how did you essentially uncover that opportunity that there wasn't kind of that almost single source of truth, essentially, to be able to get the visibility, get the opportunity, maybe even get access to certain allocations or certain opportunities to invest, where you essentially come in and provide that, you know, that package deal, that single platform that there's, you know, puts you in charge as an individual, as a family office, or as an investor. Maybe talk a little bit further. How is that different from the traditional investment banking or risk management? And what are some of the components of what you're trying to build around now at InvestBank that really gives you that unfair advantage, that opportunity for a regular investor to come in to InvestBank and say, here's what I'm trying to do. And, you know, here's my, you know, objective overall from a long-term perspective, and just maybe speak a little bit further from the standpoint of how InvestBank is capable of catering to some of those needs.
Thank you. Love that question. So if you don't mind, before answering it, I'll take a step back, right? Let's look at, so I explained the industry problem. There's also obviously a generational problem that the investor itself, themselves are changing, because, you know, by 2025, 75% of the world's workforce are going to be millennials. By 2030, millennials are going to be the biggest group of investors. And obviously, there will be a lot more unhappy with the state of, you know, how investment platforms are. And I think we're on the precipice of a huge revolution in digital investing for affluent investors in general. And to explain it better, let's look at what's happening in the industry right now. And let's look at mass market first. We believe mass market is relatively well covered and well served, because starting from simpler, easy to use platforms like Wealthfront, Betterment, Robinhood, all the way to comprehensive platforms available for retail or mass market investors like Interactive Brokers, Ameritrade, and whatnot. Pretty much, considering the ticket size, I think it's pretty well covered. Now let's look at the very other, you know, the other tail end, ultra high net worth. And for the, you know, sake of the discussion, they're normally classified as 30 million and above, but let's say even 10 million and above, right? Let's call them ultra high net worth for the sake of the discussion. That sector is also very much crowded from simpler service-oriented platforms like LGT, Liechtenstein Private Bank, the Bodier, Lionheart, these are all old Swiss names, very, very much service-oriented, to all the way to comprehensive investment platforms like Goldman, JP Morgan Private Banking, where, you know, you come, it's a lot more professional, there are a lot more opportunities available, more product oriented, one could say that way. But what about anything in the middle? let's call it from a $100,000 investment ticket to 10 million. There's very little in that segment. So there are robos like Betterment Wealthfront and their competitors trying to enter that market. But basically what they're doing for now is they're taking their basic robo service, which is not suitable for affluent clients, for many reasons, and adding few elements to that. I mean, a little bit of venture, a little bit of that, a little bit of that. It works for some, but only for a small percentage. Then we have mid-tier platforms, like some banks have like Citi Gold. Like you have Citi Private Bank, there's Citi Gold. And then there's DBS Private Banking, there's DBS Treasures. These platforms have a fraction of the asset classes that private banks have, and they have five times the cost. It's like simply prohibitive. It's impossible, right? And then how about comprehensive platforms like JP Morgan, but for this segment? Zero, right? There is Alpian and SwissQuote, which are great platforms, but they're more focused on Europe, more focused on Asia. But also they don't have private, they don't have, for example, venture secondaries. But that amazes me. For example, Jean, if I came to you and said, I'll give you a digital investing platform that has whatever Interactive has, that has in addition some private assets, private equity funds, but also has venture secondaries, also has VC funds, also has blockchain-based fractionalization engine that offers you, real estate, fractionalized US real estate. Wouldn't that sound appealing?
Of course.
So our first unfair advantage is the segment and the client and the geography we're targeting. The second is feature set. So private assets being one, right? Feature set. Second feature is we have an AI advisor. We're building, this is going to sound a lot, but actually, if you know how you're doing it, it's actually all fits and all actually becomes part of the offering. We have our own proprietary value scoring AI, and we're also embedding a third party sourced, one of our investors is helping us to build it, alpha scoring algorithm. So one algo will help you find your right ESG scores, and it's all in-house. Find your companies that have that fall into a certain value category. For example, high corporate social responsibility, gender equality, equality of pay. And on the other hand, you have an alpha scoring algorithm, which will show you the probability of a certain asset outperforming its benchmark or generally performing well. Mm-hmm. So we believe, by combining one we call value AI and the other we call IQ AI, you'll actually have a holistic way to invest. Mm. That's the second, feature set, this. And the third, but not the least, embedded finance, right? That's the name. So what we're going to allow and what we're building is, so first phase of Invest Bank is a platform where you will be able to access equities, bonds, funds, venture secondaries, alternatives in general, eventually digital assets. But the second version, in the roadmap, will have an opportunity for third-party product suppliers, product producers and service providers to come into our platform and distribute their offerings. And it's all learnings we received from traditional private banking. Mm-hmm. So what does traditional private banking offer? Aggregation, we address that. The other thing traditional private banking offers is access to all of these amazing fund managers. Mm-hmm. But the problem right now is that all private banks are sticking to your millenniums and Schroders, Charles Schwab's of this world. And that's fine because that's less risk, I suppose. We're going to have that too. But how about Big Sky? right? Once Big Sky becomes, you know, operates a few years, you know, minimum 3 years track record, and has a certain amount of assets under management, you know, if you're going to approach a private bank, they'll tell you, you guys look amazing. You know, you sound well, you look well, you perform well. But you know what? We would like to have you 300 million AUM minimum and 3 years track record. In fact, what they mean is they want you to have 1 billion asset management assets under management and 5 years track record. And they're going to take 1 or 2 years to doing due diligence on you before letting on their platform. And when they let you on their platform, they're going to ask 30% of all your fees. That's the modus operandi. What we're saying is, because we're a digital private bank, we're going to have an embedded finance function, you know, capabilities where suppliers of interesting products such as yourself can come to the platform, of course, undergo due diligence and subject to, you know, a committee selecting, get access. So on top of having, you know, all the asset classes, we're going to spice it up with things like that. And I think it's important to make a distinction here. I know that sounds like a big task, which it is. We're a very ambitious team, but this is our 10-year plan. So what sets our team apart is that when we tell this is a 10-year plan, they're not scared, right? Because they're in this for the long haul.
I like that. And the long-term view at the core of any type of investment vehicle strategy is always, you know, an unfair advantage, because at the end of the day, it's very rare to have that muscle, that long-term view. It's very difficult to master. It's very challenging because we all humans, we want instant gratification. We want immediate results. I mean, we deal with that on a daily basis on the venture side. So that, you know, that makes a lot of sense when you're talking about kind of the comprehensive suite of tools, essentially, and being able to provide that access and provide, you know, everything in the single source of truth to be able to go from deal sourcing to deal analysis to actually winning the deal. That's great. And having a very specific audience in mind, I think that also sets you apart from just catering to the masses, because I'm sure you understand how that mentality works, what's important to that type of demographic. So that's, thank you for highlighting that. So that's great. You know, I'm ready. Where do I write the check? Just let me know where to send that to. So it's definitely a very compelling argument for, you know, InvestBank and what you guys are trying to build. On the different side of the spectrum,
you appreciate you saying that. I'll send you the bank details. Thank
you. Okay. So on a different side of the spectrum, I want to get your take on kind of a little bit more of a adventurous side, I guess. I'm talking about venture, talking about VC space. And you've been dabbing, you've been pretty active in venture yourself for quite some time. I understand we actually in a few deals together. And when my partner Adil in the fund, he said, you know, here's a cap table, all Olzhas is in. That was it. Let's do this. So tell us a little bit more about your framework, your view into the venture, more specifically around, I understand we invest early stage, extremely early stage, where most of the due diligence is around the founders or the founding team. What are some of the characteristics that you look for in founders when you meet them? And more importantly, talk us through that first set of conversations that you have with them, the types of questions you ask. What do you look for in their responses? And what are some of the triggers or the flags that go off in your kind of the analysis machine, your own AI algorithm in your head that really tells you, okay, this is something that sets that founder, you know, from the rest of the, you know, the entrepreneurs that I'm seeing on a daily basis. Tell us a little bit more about that framework. What do you look for? And maybe some of the, you know, examples, if you could share, questions being asked or scenarios presented that really help you uncover that personality trait.
Absolutely. And thank you for the question. So I started my venture investing career in 2015, when I actually started, you know, making enough capital to do that. And back then, I asked myself what I want to do with that capital. And you know, that story of how the venture in me came to be lies in the fact that I'm actually a graduate of a physics specialized school. So at a certain point in time, I was really into sciences before switching to management and finance. And actually, at a certain point in time, I almost went to study to in a highly specialized physics university in Moscow. Thank God I didn't. But I had that thought. My school actually had relationships with few physics specialized universities. So my big dream as a teenager was to invent nuclear fusion and give clean electricity to the whole world. Nuclear fusion reactor, I mean. So not the fusion cell. So, but I quickly realized the problem of Central Asia. Lots of talent, zero venture capital. I didn't know it was called venture capital at that point in time, but I realized that this type of capital that is present in development was absolutely absent, not non-existent. So that's when and where I realized I need to actually go a different route, and then maybe I can help this in some other way. So that's when it happened. And then in 2015, I said, here is, what can I do now? So I wrote myself a declaration, right? An impact investment strategy. It's simple, but I follow it till this day. First, supporting frontier technologies. And what I mean by that is supporting technologies that can make the world a better place. So I have an agri-tech investment. I have an innovative financial services company or some other companies, education technology companies that truly can make society or the world in general a better place. Second, supporting frontier founders. So founders from jurisdictions, immigrant founders. I know you're very much into that, and I respect that a lot. So founders always have to swim against the tide. Founders in Central Asia, where there's still very little venture capital, or other jurisdictions where they're struggling with VC, raising rounds. And third, diversity and inclusion. It's more of an overarching principle that, one or this element has to be present one way or the other in the companies. So that way I started investing. As of today, I have 14 portfolio companies. One died, one became a unicorn. A few of them are very proud of nearly or growth stage already. ARR is growing at a tremendous pace, which I'm enjoying very much. And yeah, it's especially in Central Asia, it's great to find like-minded individuals such as yourself and Adil, because there is so very few people doing that and supporting certain jurisdictions. Central Asia is not alone. There are multiple jurisdictions around the world with this problem. And it's so I have companies like obviously around the world, but a good half of my portfolio is in Central Asia. Yeah, there, which is home to some amazing founders. With time, I even found a brand for it. I call it Tesla Capital, after Nikola Tesla, one of my favorite people on this planet. Really? It took me. It was a battle to register that trademark in Singapore, because of Tesla's lawyers. Tesla's trademark lawyers are very experienced. Uh-huh. So they managed to trademark Tesla's name. I was shocked by it, but yeah, I managed to pull through and trademark Tesla Capital in Singapore. So yeah, that's the brand now that's it's under. So that's the kind of companies I look like. What kind of people I look for. So I'm obviously I can go through my standard due diligence process, but that's something that, everybody on listening to this podcast will know. But what are some of the other things I look at? I believe one of the strength of me looking at companies that maybe some I look at exclusively seed stage with my capital, with my own money, because that's where I can do most impact. That's their tickets are affordable for individuals such as myself, yourself. And that's where actually this is what I understand the most, companies that are likely to go from C to Series A. That's what I believe I understand. And then I hand it over to the Series A lead and say, now you take care of this. People, I do a lot on what I call founder due diligence. And I see a lot of seed funds underappreciate or ignore that. And I believe that's something where you can find a lot of value in founder due diligence, where the founder comes from, what kind of history he or she or they have. What kind of family situations they're in. The worst risk for a seed stage startup is not that, they won't be able to execute or something. The worst risk is founder is going to die in a plane crash. Of course, that's something you cannot predict. But founder goes through a divorce. The startup is done for. You can forget about it, write it off, because the amount of, in that kind of situation, the amount of stress the person is going to be under is going to drive the company under a bus. So where he or she or they are in terms of mental space, capacity, do they have the right support system? And I don't mean a social net, because, for example, a lot of immigrant founders have zero social net. But do they have the support system, the right support system, the friends, the family? So I obviously some of the things are inappropriate to ask, but I try to gauge around, the accessible information, what's coming off of them. I even got a coaching degree for that. I don't practice coaching, at least not professionally, but I have a certified. I have a degree from Newfield, which is an American company famous for that. Just because I want to understand people better, what drives people better. And I think if I had to outline one question or one set of questions, it's around what motivates the founders and what kind of support systems they have.
Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. Around the psychology of the mentality, the mental fitness, mental toughness, of the founders, that's at the core. And oftentimes it's overlooked. Everybody just wants to jump straight to numbers, the AR, MRR, all the attraction, all of the numbers. But at the end of the day, like you were saying, the most important elements of just the key ingredients of potential company successes around that resiliency, that the personal traits, ability to deal with that adversity. And that applies, to all of us. So I think I definitely respect the fact that you utilize that so extensively as part of your due diligence process, especially in the early stages and the seed stage you mentioned, the companies that you're talking to. Makes a lot of sense. As far as kind of how you build your team around yourself, and how you recruit, how you retain talent, surrounding yourself with the top talent, you as at the head of your organization is at the top of your mind 24/7, whether you're actively recruiting or not. Same for me, same for a lot of other CEOs. That's a fact. Share some of your personal strategies that really help you attract that top talent to your team that's complementary to your skill set, to your weaknesses, things that you're missing, things that you're not good at. And how are you capable of attracting such talent, number one? And then what is that selection criteria, that evaluation criteria that you go through as part of that interview process or other, engagements that you coordinate with potential candidates? Talk to us a little bit further about that.
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. So especially now, there are a few things that we do to create the workspace and the feeling of being a part of the company and then fostering it. And I'll tell that because it's an important aspect of our company. And then it translates into how we hire and how we retain talent. So for example, at Invest Bank, emotional intelligence is something that we talk about a lot and something that we foster in our people, so much so that, for example, in our Singapore office, and there are various, because Almaty office is big, but we're in the process of building it out right now. Singapore office is more established in its practices, but that's going to translate all over the world in wherever we're present. In Singapore office, if you're joining InvestBank, one of the primary requirements is for a person to attend a leadership course. So there is a leadership course that I like very much. It takes only 5 days, but it can be transformational. And it's all about facing yourself. It's all about acknowledging fears. And it's all about learning a new way to communicate with myself and people around me. And that's how my coaching journey started, with this, and understanding myself better so that I can understand other people better. We call it taking an emotional shower, right? So before entering the company, after you passed the process of onboarding or the selection, one goes through that, and only then is let into the company's workplace, into the inner sanctum, so-called. Because we have 20, 25 people right now. We're a small organization, right? And every single individual is going to make an impact of how people inside the company feel themselves, of how holistic is the workplace. So we're very careful before letting any people in. So it's about, after the person joins, how they stay, how they grow, and how they feel inside the company. Now, before people join, the selection process, one of the important aspects that we look at is alignment. So we state and we share at length what the company is about, what's the vision. And if the person, even if it's an administrative role, can that person get behind the vision of the company? And is that something that they're excited in? If not, however strong they are, however capable they are, I mean, it's not going to work. And the person himself, themselves, also understands that if what we're doing and they're not aligned with it, it's not going to work. We tell upfront that right now we're in a startup mode. So there are going to be things like, working longer hours that we're not going to pay for. They're going to be this and that. But this is what we're trying to achieve. This is what we're building. And I will be there, right there with you. I work extremely long hours. Everyone in the company knows that. So, we're all aligned. We're all doing the same. And there is alignment and goals and vision and how everyone works. And that is supported by the workplace, by the environment we've created, which is holistic. There is very little toxicity. So even if people are tired, they still have support from each other. Financial motivation, like people say financial motivation rarely works. Yes, a purely on its own doesn't work. But of course, employee stock option plan, we tell everyone in the company, like literally everyone, including all roles, 1 year into the company, if you have worked and you like it, you like what you see, you're aligned with the vision of the company, we like who you are, we like what you're representing, we can sit down and discuss any ESOP plan. However small, large that is, minuscule, big, it's going to depend on the contribution and, of course, the motivation of that particular person. But you can apply for it. We can sit down and discuss, the vesting schedule and, the amount of options and what it's going to represent. We're very transparent in that. Hiring process, we are looking for strong people because we have to be very careful about how the operational burden and the expenses, but we look for strong and capable individuals. So as much as everyone, we try to get to know them as much as possible. But frankly, the interviews are short. There are a few core questions on a personal level we ask, but we cannot go beyond that because it will be just inappropriate. We try to get as much as we can. But then we also say, we also go through all of these things. People come and see the environment they're working on in. And we tell them, after a year, let's sit down and see if you want to jump with us, you know, for the long run. Like, do you subscribe to the 10-year story?
How can you gauge that long-term muscle in the candidate? What are some of the maybe questions you ask, or what do you see, or do you just trust your initial gut instincts when you have that conversation? Maybe combination of those things. How do you gauge that? Because it's motivation is a very challenging aspect, and people's interests and everything change very quick, you know, myself included. What's the framework? How do you identify that? What do you look for?
So I'm sorry if I'm giving everything piecemeal, but we have this very holistic view of how we are. Obviously, I cannot explain it within one call, but that's why I'm trying to touch on as many important aspects as we can. Sure. But obviously, Mike, like we make mistakes. It's not. So when the way I try to gauge the long-term muscle is I simply ask, say, we're looking for people for the long haul. But that's why we say after a year, and a lot of people will say yes, probably, but not everyone will mean it. Like, are you in this for the long haul? Say yes, on enthusiasm, even believing themselves at that point. But then time passes on, you know, hard work begins, and that sort of changes people's minds, and that's okay. That's why we say after a year, because we know we're going to make mistakes. We know we're going to, you know, make some good hires and some bad hires. After a year, you know, if the person lasts a year and starts discussing ESOP plan with you, it's highly likely that they have the long-term muscle. And if they fall out before that long-term, highly likely there's some unpredictable situation that, you know, we have no control over. But that's our take on it.
And I like that, because at the end of the day, it's also, like you mentioned, if the very first initial conversation is around that ESOP plan, then it's probably, you know, small indicator that the person maybe is just, first of all, is interested in their personal goals, or, you know, just maybe a shorter term view. So that's a definitely very interesting take. The other part that also I'm picking up in some of the examples that you're giving is ability to identify what really drives that person, you know, on a personal level. What are they passionate about? What are they interested in? What is something that they're tinkering with outside of working hours, for example? What are they thinking about maybe in the shower? That's not really the visual, but it's kind of the framework of personal passions, goals, and interests, and how can you translate that to what you currently need? What is the gap? What are the, you know, the areas of help that you guys need within your organization? Try to match that and see how that could collaborate, they could live together when you try to form that very long-term view. So that makes a lot of sense. As a CEO yourself, and you talk to a lot of other CEOs, you talk to a lot of founders on a daily basis, whether that, you know, at Invest Bank or even as part of your venture arm, I realize it's a loaded question and it's a combination of things, but as the main area of focus and responsibility as a CEO, or as a CEO of the company that you're looking to invest in, what's your view on that? What's the number one thing that the CEO should focus on if you were to choose just one area of responsibility? It's an ongoing debate. I have that all the time with my network, it's different views, but I'm curious just to get your take on that perspective.
I agree. It's a loaded question, no wonder there's a lot of debate. As much, you know, there's a lot of debate about around leadership in general. And if I had to pick one thing, I would say bringing the best in people.
Ooh,
all right,
nailed it. That's it.
Thank you. And I know it sounds simplistic, but there are many names for it. Leadership as a coach, you know, that there are many fancy names, but I think the simple truth behind that, bringing the best in people, creating an enabling environment where everyone can be the best version of themselves, right? Of course, CEO has a lot of responsibilities and, you know, a lot of work and operational stuff, especially, you know, in early stages of the company that everyone needs to do. But that, I think, the core responsibility that a CEO cannot ignore. Because if a CEO is not there, that leadership presence is not there, there will be no alignment, there will be no, you know, there will be no little creativity, there will be little motivation to do anything beyond, you know, 5 bullet points that you gave on the job description.
Crushed it. I love it, because that's the top of my list. That's, you know, I encounter CEOs on a daily basis that are so sales driven, that numbers driven, that my only number one job is to sell, and numbers, and bringing as much business as possible. I wholeheartedly disagree with that, because like what you've been highlighting is it's a very short term view, and it does not create and foster that type of culture within the organization, and it's very short term lived. So recruiting and hiring and surrounding yourself with the top talent, 100%. In my book, that's the number one responsibility for CEO, and it's the most challenging task that I can definitely attest that it's fixing the hiring mistakes is probably the costliest areas for a company to fix. Once you make that bad hire and you try to make that work and you try to work through that, but it's still at the end of the day, very rarely it works out. So that's perfect. Thank you for that. You clearly know what leadership is all about. You study that, you actually put a lot of your new hires through that training, which is rare, but it's extremely important. From kind of your personal content diet, you invest a lot into investing in other people. You try to bring a lot of value to your network. You try to be that value add investor, you know, your whole career. But as far as bringing value to yourself, and how do you keep yourself informed? How do you keep yourself educated? How do you keep that muscle, mental fitness going? Share some personal sources for that personal content diet. What do you consume on a daily basis? What are some of the sources, you know, whether that's books, podcasts, conversations with friends and family, things like that? Maybe just paint a little bit of a picture from into the that regimen of all jobs.
Absolutely. Thank you. So generally about, you know, nurturing myself, feeding myself, it took me a while to develop, you know, a system around it. It was mostly episodic when I was younger, but happy to say that a lot more systematic about self-care again. Not always, but often. And I think it is crucial. Self-care is crucial for any high performing individual. You know, there again, a lot of fancy words around it. Love you. If you cannot love yourself, you cannot love anyone else. A lot of it is true, but you know, the core is, you know, self-care is important for any high performing professional. So I divide it into 3 domains, right? Spiritual domain, emotional domain, and physical domain. And I think the first I should address is the physical domain, because like I find it, if you want to change, you know, and be resilient emotionally, spiritually, and you need to change one thing, it's the physical domain. Because when you change that, everything else starts improving, and then, so I have a daily regimen, a few things that I do on the physical domain. It's, of course, I have my supplementation schedule. Anti-aging medicine is real. It works. I was so blessed to find a specialist that I have in Singapore. Her name is Dr. Caroline Low. I think she's a genius in terms of, so it's rare to find a doctor that you know, being healthy is not enough. You know, how about being a high performing organism, biological organism? So that's how she thinks. So she studies you, does completely different tests, and gives, okay, to be in optimal capacity, your body's lacking this and this and this. And again, we're not ideal. We have our own, things, and we can improve. But yeah, working with her has increased my capacity for all things. And then I developed various habits, supplementation schedule, which really works. Then I have developed various drinks. I have my own recipe for bulletproof coffee that actually made a difference in my life over the long term. I can share that.
I'm definitely going to ask for that and put that in the episode show notes for everybody else.
Absolutely. So I did a lot of experimentation on that, right? And it's over, it's again, the long term that matters. So over multiple years, I've developed that coffee. You add MCT oil, coconut oil ideally, medium chain triglyceride oil, which quickly absorbed in the body, gives you sustainable energy. Then ginger, turmeric. I don't necessarily use ghee. I think not exactly compulsory. So these four components, and then black pepper. There are multiple reasons why this combination. Now, on the surface, it's not for everyone to swallow. So here's a secret: you add oat milk or almond milk.
Sounds pretty disgusting, actually.
Yeah, it does. But hear this: add oat milk or almond milk. Now, that is going to make it palatable for a lot of people, not for everyone, but for a lot of people. Now that's true. And then I have other things that I do, I have my exercises, and you know, so that's what I do on the physical domain. And you know, emotional for me, emotional health and how I feed myself emotionally is, you know, spending time with family. I'm a family man, and now my life has improved significantly. You know, there's a child in our lives, so there's a kid as well. So, of course, that improves emotional well-being. Some nights, maybe not, but overall, yes. Overall, yes, tremendous improvement. and education, emotional intelligence education, various books I can talk about, things that I've read that helped me and continue my improving on this. Working with a coach, these kind of things. There are multiple things. Working with a coach is powerful. Consuming the right content is powerful, right? Feed your mind daily, as saying goes. Yeah, I mean, putting some kind of inspiring content into your life daily, I think, is important. We're not machines. Like, I tried going, my life is I only have this many hours a day. Morning I do this, evening I do this, at night I only do this, because this is productive, no distractions, right? A month later you want to shoot yourself because it's just in the evening it should be something that nourishes the mind, right? Spiritual. I do Wim Hof every day. Wim Hof exercises every day. I am very grateful I discovered Wim Hof by myself. Again, one day is not going to make a difference. Over the course of a year, it becomes an addiction, right? When you wake up, Wim Hof, center myself, go about it. And one last thing, hot yoga. It used to be called Bikram yoga before scandal, and not anymore. I think rightfully so, hot yoga. Amazing stuff. Am I answering your question, or am I leading in the wrong direction?
No, 1000%. Actually, you've made my simple question into a lot more insightful view, which my mind is spinning, because that's such an important space for me. You're mentioning a lot of the things, a lot of moving parts, that it's a more of a holistic approach to that rather than just, you know, segregating and segmenting things out, which definitely begs for, you know, an episode two with you to actually go into a lot of these different strategies, because that's such a personal passion of mine. You know, my wife is building a career actually in that, just the personal overall holistic well-being. So it's it resonates on so many levels, you know, from just the kind of the self-care and, you know, working with a coach, you know, the fitness, you know, mental fitness professional. To me, that's been transformative, you know, just overall and ongoing. It's something that, you know, a very famous quote that I really, really like that goes with, between the lines of honor, oh, beware of those who have found the truth and honor those who are constantly seeking it. So I kind of that I kept thinking about that quote as you were talking about just that really designing just the overall lifestyle around that. I think that's super important. Last but not least, Aljaz, you've mentioned a few books that have had a profound effect on just you as a person, maybe as a professional, just overall. If you were to highlight maybe a book or two that you always recommend to others, share some of these examples with us. And while you're thinking about that, I'll share mine that I just finished, you know, literally a couple of weeks ago. That's just been incredibly interesting. Well, actually two. One of them is called Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss. And what he's done is actually created a compilation of these thousands of interviews with just amazing people from all walks of life. And he just interviewed them and asked all these very interesting, insightful questions. And he summarized their answers into this just this one book called Tools of Titans. So highly recommend that. A lot of the interesting, you know, strategies, kind of like what you and I discussed today, from career, from, you know, just personal aspects. So that's number one. And number two is the, I forgot the name, but I'll link that, is essentially Autobiography of Michael Jordan. It's a huge book. It's like 800 pages, but it really takes you back to kind of who his parents were, who his grandparents were, where they come from, just overall, where that whole DNA actually gets born. So that was just an incredible view in just who he is as a person and how he just overall views the hard work and just the overall, the competition aspects. So those two books were very, very interesting in the last few weeks.
I'm just, you know, I'm just straight away just making some notes for myself. I think it's called Michael Jordan, The Life.
Yes.
And Tools of Titans. All right. Thanks. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I'll have a look at those. So books that I read lately that were transformational. First, I was just remembering the name because I remember the author, Professor James Goodwin. I forgot the exact name. It's called Supercharge Your Brain. An amazing book. And here's what's amazing about it. And, you know, it has a little bit of evolutionary notes like Sapiens. It has, it brings about some, you know, nutritional advice, brings around some, you know, explanations of how we are, you know, how we evolved, how we are, why certain things and certain trends in modern society are happening. I'm trying to describe it without spoiling the book. That's why I'm walking circles. But basically, this book has so much insights on how we are, how we were, and how we could be. It really talks a lot about how to perform better. It's very precise. It's not boring. It's written in light language, in digestible language, but it's very precise. And it gives a massive amount of insights, right? On massive amount, how to be a better me. I would say that's how I take this book, how to be a better me. And, you know, some like little things in daily routine that are going to be built into amazing habits in over 10 years. But not just saying to do them, but explaining how that exactly, what kind of mechanisms it triggers in your body. Mm-hmm. So that's why I enjoyed Supercharge Your Brain among maybe other books of similar genre. And the other is Outliers Malcolm Gladwell. Have you?
Yes, I read all of his books.
Yeah. Great book, massive insights, and I think especially valuable for parents. Right. So yeah, those are two books, I would say.
Oh, great, great recommendations. We're definitely going to link those in the episode show notes. And also, I can't thank you enough for your time today. The hour and a half flew by just like 10 minutes. It was very mentally, you know, stimulating conversation. Lots of great insights. Personally learned quite a bit. Definitely begs for an episode 2, 3, and 4 to get into a lot of the details that we've touched upon. So I'm definitely going to reach out and try to get that scheduled as well. Again, thank you enough for your time today. I know that's super late in Singapore right now, so I will let you go. I'll let you go to your family, but definitely appreciate your time today.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.